So tonight I want to share with you the Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving, which is in the Middle Length Discourses, and it's number 38. Now, I should say before I start discussing this, I have no idea what happens after we die. I mean, I don't ever remember dying. Haven't died this time yet. So I got some ideas, you know, some guesses. And I don't want to mess up anybody's immortality project, but, you know, I'm going to give you this sutta. And, well, you take it for whatever it's worth. Okay. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetas Grove, Anathapindika's park. Anathapindika was a very rich merchant, and he went to visit his brother-in-law in Rajagaha, the other major city at the time of the Buddha. And his brother-in-law was very busy preparing a feast, and so Anathapindika asked, well, is the king coming? No, the Buddha. Buddha? You mean a fully awakened one? Yeah. You got a Buddha around here? Yeah, he's coming tomorrow for dinner, for lunch. Wow. Anathapindika was pretty excited. He wanted to go see the Buddha right away, but it was at night, and it wasn't a good time. And he couldn't sleep. And finally, he got up before dawn, and he knew the Buddha was staying in the bamboo grove, which was nearby. And he went there and he encountered the Buddha and was very impressed. And eventually invited the Buddha to come spend the rains retreat in Savatthi. And the Buddha said, well, it's not a place that's really going to work. It's not a big enough monastery. And Anathapindika said, don't worry about that. I'll take care of it. So he went back, found Jetas mango grove, beautiful grove, and decided this would be the perfect place to build a monastery. He went to Prince Jeta and asked to buy the mango grove, and Prince Jeta said no. And this, of course, it happened three times. And the third time he goes, Prince Jeta says, okay, I'll sell it to you if you can cover the whole ground with gold coins. And Anathapindika goes, sold. And wait, no, I was only kidding. But Prince Jeta's friends say, no, you already said it. You got to do it. I guess they wanted to see the ground covered in gold coins. And that's what Anathapindika did. Except he ran out of gold coins near the entryway. And Prince Jeta was like, okay, I'll give you that as a discount. And so it's retained the name Jetas Grove Anathapindika's Park, and we have a lot of suttas that take place there because the Buddha spent 25 rains retreats. Rains retreats are the rainy season in India, and at that time it was not good for the monks and nuns to go on alms round because they might trample on the newly planted rice plants which were underwater, and so they stayed in the monastery, and their lay followers would bring them food. And they had a nice retreat as well. Now, on that occasion, a pernicious view had arisen in a bhikkhu named Sati, the son of a fisherman. He thought, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. When we think about what runs through the rounds of rebirth, we look at our body and go, yep, this is probably not going to survive death, all right? So it must be something else. And the Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neither, comes and goes pretty rapidly, probably not that. Our concepts, conceptualizations, that's pretty fleeting. Our thoughts, our emotions, that changes a lot. Our memories, those not too terribly good. Our intentions, so probably not sankharas, but consciousness. Yeah, I mean, it's always there. Every time I look, I've got consciousness, right? It's got to be that. And so this is what people really most want to identify with. And Sati has decided that it's his consciousness that gets reborn. Several bhikkhus, having heard about this, went to the bhikkhu Sati and asked him, "Friend Sati, is it true that such a pernicious view is risen in you?" And he said, "Oh, yes, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it's this very consciousness that roams and wanders through the rounds of rebirth." "Don't say that, Sati, for on many occasions, the Blessed One has said that consciousness is a dependently arisen phenomenon, since without a condition, there's no origin of consciousness." Okay, so these monks are trying to persuade Sati otherwise. Yet though they pressed and questioned and cross-questioned Sati, he would not give up his pernicious view. And so those monks went to see the Blessed One, told him what had transpired, told him they couldn't shake him of his pernicious view. And the Buddha said, "You, tell Sati the master calls." And so that monk went to see Sati and said to Sati, "The teacher calls you, friend Sati." "Yes, friend," Sati replied, and went to the Blessed One, paid homage, sat down to one side. Then the Blessed One asked him, "Sati, is it true that the following view has arisen in you? As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another." "Exactly so, Venerable Sir, as I understand the Dhamma." Yeah. "What is consciousness, Sati?" Good question. What is consciousness? "Venerable Sir, it is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad action." Okay, so consciousness, that's what's behind your speech. So right now, my consciousness is making these words and projecting them out into the room. And feels, right? Yeah, I feel the pressure of sitting. I feel the coolness of the air and the warmth where my shirt is, you know, making it a little warmer, right? That's my consciousness. I'm conscious of that stuff, right? And experiences here and there are the results of good and bad actions. In other words, that's the karma, the karmic resultants. I do an action and I'm conscious of the results, right? Right? The Buddha replies, "Misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition, there is no origination of consciousness? But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp, injured yourself, and stored up much demerit. Well, this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." And I don't think the Buddha agreed with Sati. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, what do you think? Has this bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and discipline?" How could he, Venerable Sir? No, Venerable Sir. "Whatever you do, don't misrepresent the Buddha's teachings." When this was said, the bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. Then knowing this, the Blessed One told him, "Misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view." And here we are, 2,500 years later, recognizing poor old Sati because of his pernicious view. "I shall question the bhikkhus on this matter." Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. "Bhikkhus, do you understand the Dhamma taught by me, the same as Sati?" "No, Venerable Sir, for in many ways the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, for without a condition there is no origination of consciousness." "Good, bhikkhus, it's good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in this way, for that's what I've said a lot." "Bhikkhus, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on eye and forms, it's reckoned as eye consciousness. When it arises dependent on ear and sounds, ear consciousness, nose and smells, nose consciousness, tongue and taste, tongue consciousness, body and textures, body consciousness, mind and mind objects, mind consciousness. Just as a fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns. When fire burns dependent on logs, it's reckoned as a log fire. When fire burns dependent on faggots, it's a faggot fire. Dependent on grass, a grass fire. Dependent on cow dung fire. Dependent on chaff, chaff fire. On rubbish, a rubbish fire. So too, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. Now, last night when we were talking about consciousness, we said it arises dependent on mind and body. And we also said consciousness arises dependent on sankharas. And now we have a third thing that consciousness arises dependent upon. It arises dependent upon sensory input. It could be five sense input, so the object is external, right? Or it could be sixth sense consciousness, mental activity, thoughts, emotions, memories, intentions, okay? But there's no such thing as objectless consciousness. Consciousness always arises dependent on an object, and the object enters into consciousness via one of the six senses. Now, what follows in this sutta is, it's called a catechism by the scholars. You might remember catechism from your Sunday school days. It's a series of questions, and you're supposed to memorize the answers to them. And so there are multiple times in the suttas where we find somebody asking questions and somebody else answering. This was a good way to teach the monks what the doctrine was with a catechism like this. So remember, the monks are memorizing this stuff in later generations. And so as they're memorizing this, they're memorizing the questions and answers. And it appears that this sutta had some questions in it originally, and then it got quite a few more shoved in. We find this occurring multiple times in the suttas. So we have the story of Sati, and then the Buddha starts asking questions, and then somebody starts shoving more and more in. But it starts out, "Bhikkhus, do you see this has come to be?" The commentaries make a big deal about figuring out what the this is that has come to be. And they decide that the Buddha is going, "Bhikkhus, do you see that this," meaning my body, "has come to be?" But actually, I think what the Buddha's asking, "Bhikkhus, when something comes to be, do you understand it comes to be?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." "Do you see its origin, its origination occurs with this as nutriment, that this, whatever it is, has arisen dependent on something else?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." "Bhikkhus, do you see, with the cessation of that nutriment, what comes to be is subject to cessation?" So if there are no more supporting conditions for what has come to be, do you understand that what has come to be ceases? "Yes, Venerable Sir." And then the questions go on. There's lots of them about, do you really understand? Do you sometimes get confused? It goes on. We get the 12 links of dependent origination in the forward order, and then we get the reverse order, a forward arising order, then the reverse arising order, and on and on and on and on and on. And then we get the recapitulation on arising. And then after that, we get the forward exposition on ceasing. And then we get the reverse questionnaire on ceasing. And then finally, we get the recapitulation on ceasing. This is one of the most tedious passages in the whole canon. And Yeah, if you're interested, you should read it. And you'll probably only want to read it once. But it does have everything that you could possibly want to memorize about dependent origination. You know, forward order, reverse order, arising, ceasing, you know, all this sort of stuff. But it's very clear what the Buddha is doing is asking questions about dependent origination. How well do you understand the teachings on dependent origination? And it's also fairly clear from a scholastic standpoint that this questionnaire got improved on with all this other stuff that got stuck in there. And then eventually we get to the heart of the matter. Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, that is in terms of dependently originated phenomena, would you run back to the past thus? Were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what? What did we become in the past? No, venerable sir. Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, would you run forward to the future thus? Shall we be in the future? Shall we not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? No, venerable sir. Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, that is looking at everything in terms of dependently originating phenomena, and in particular, one's, quote, self, knowing and seeing in this way, would you now be inwardly perplexed about the present thus? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? No, venerable sir. If you truly understand dependent origination, then the questions of did I exist in the past, or what was I in the past, or will I exist in the future, or what will I be in the future, or who am I now and what's going on, those questions don't occur, right? So like, you go to the beach. No, you guys go to the shore, right? Okay, and you stand ankle deep in the water, and you look out, and you can see the edge of the world, right? I mean, you know, a ship gets too close, sailed over the edge. I've seen it happen so many times. All those people die. It's terrible. I always wondered, when they fall off the edge of the world, do they die instantly? Or, you know, do they fall for a long time? Do they fall faster and faster and it burns them up? Or do they fall and eventually, you know, die of thirst? Or do they starve to death? Okay, if you understand that there's no edge of the world and it's an optical illusion, these sort of questions are ridiculous, right? They don't occur to you. You don't think, well, if somebody sails off the edge of the world, they starve to death before when they fall down. It just doesn't occur. If you can look at the world in terms of dependently originated phenomena, if you can see that there's nothing but streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting, sotapai, right? Streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting, SODAPI, then the questions of was I in the past, will I be in the future, what's going on with me right now, doesn't arise. You're actually looking at the world from a very different perspective, other than me, the most important being in the universe, which is our usual perspective. So this idea of looking at the world in terms of dependently originating phenomena is the answer. The Buddha doesn't say, no, you idiot, it's not consciousness that's reborn, it's this other thing that's reborn. No, he says, you're asking silly questions. You're asking, how do you die if you fall off the edge of the world? Right? Starve to death, die of thirst, hit something on the way down. No, those questions don't make any sense. We tend to concretize ourselves as entities, but we are just the intersection of a lot of dependently originated phenomena, right? There's the genetic bits, right, that you got from your parents. There's the family of origin bits that you got from your family of origin. There's the food, right? I mean, today you are what you've eaten, right? You are what you eat. They say that. You're also what you eat ate. Do you think about that? You're what you eat ate. Right, so if you're eating animals and they're eating antibiotics, you've got extra antibiotics in you. If they're organic animals that you're eating, well, maybe your grass that's been changed into chicken or cow or whatever. Right, so you are what you ate. You are what you eat ate. All right, you are the culture you grew up in. Right, because you're not just a physical thing. You're a mental entity. You're a mental conglomeration at this intersection. So where you went to school, who your friends were, the languages you speak, you know, all of this is playing into you. And right now, part of who you are is the fact that you came to BCBS to sit on this course and you've done some meditation and your room got flooded out and all this other stuff is, you know, feeding into who you are. All right? If you can see that's all there is, okay, then the question of what am I going to be in the future or what was I in the past doesn't really occur. And this is what the Buddha is asking. Bhikkhus, are you saying this because I'm your teacher? No, Venerable Sir. Are you saying this from your own personal experience? Yes, Venerable Sir. Do you speak only of what you have known, seen, and understood for yourselves? Right? So these monks, the ones who reported sati, yeah, they understood that what he was talking about was nonsense. Sati was being basically saying that you die of thirst on the way down when you fall off the edge of the world. And the Buddha's going, there's no edge of the world. Right? You've completely messed up what's going on. Look and see there's nothing but streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. That's all you ever find. Good bhikkhus, you have been guided by me with this Dhamma, which is visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading to be experienced by the wise for themselves. For it was with reference to this that it has been said. This Dhamma is, and it repeats what it just said. So it's with reference to looking at the world as nothing but streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting that the Dhamma is said to be visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, and to be experienced by the wise for themselves. And it has to be experienced. You're not going to get this from an intellectual understanding. The intellectual understanding can be helpful. It can give you some idea of how to interpret the experiences you're having, right? But it's really got to be a felt sense of what's going on. Now, this particular sutta, Majjhima 38, like many suttas, appears to actually be two different discourses that were jammed together. This first one, now remember the title of the sutta, is the Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. And what the craving that sati has is the craving for becoming. He wants to make sure that he becomes in his next life. All right, so he's got bhava tanha. And the Buddha is destroying bhava tanha by saying, don't look at it as an entity that's going to get reborn in a future life. Look and see there's nothing but streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. Okay? So this is the method of destroying bhava tanha. And then there's a second sutta. It's about the destruction of kama tanha, sensual desire, right? Pleasure through the senses. And there's an interesting little bridge between the two so that they can make the two suttas jam together. Sometimes you'll get two discourses jammed together and it's just like, what? That seems like a whole new sutta, and it is. And sometimes they try and make it so it sort of blends, and this one has a sort of blend. It starts out, Bhikkhus, the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. Here there is the union of mother and father, but the mother is not in season, and the Gandhava is not present. The Gandhava? Gandhava is a celestial musician. Yeah? Why do you need a celestial musician? Okay, so the English come along and they encounter this sutta and they're like, silly Indians or silly Sri Lankans probably. They think they have to have a musician there to conceive a baby, a celestial musician. And then they look in the commentaries and the commentaries say the Gandhava is the being to be born, which... Didn't the Buddha just say something about not thinking in terms of beings to be born and so forth? Never mind. Anyhow, so you got to have union of mother and father. The mother has to be in season and the Gandhava has to be present. All right? And if you don't have all three of those, no baby. Here, there is the union of mother and father, and the mother is not in season and the Gandhava is not present. Again. Right, so the couple has sex, the mother's not in season, doesn't matter whether the Gandhava is present or not, no baby. All right, but you can have union of mother and father. The mother is in season, right, time of the month, and sometimes you still don't get a baby, right? Well, what's going on there? Well, obviously the Gandhava's not present. The Indians had figured out, right, that you got to have union of mother and father or there's no baby, right? But that didn't guarantee there was going to be a baby. The mother had to be right time of the month. But even that didn't guarantee the baby. So clearly there had to be a Gandhava present, whatever that was, all right? So the being to be born or the celestial musician, which is what the word Gandhava means in all other instances in the sutta, right? But if you got all three, then the descent of the embryo takes place. The mother carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety and as a heavy burden. Then at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the noble one's discipline. Did this stuff I just read to you really make any sense, contribute to your understanding in any way? Yeah, I definitely think this was something that was tacked on to try and make the transition between the suttas go a little bit better. All right? But it just doesn't really fit, especially since it contradicts what just came before about don't get lost in there being some being there. All right, but so a kid is born. All right, we got that much. That's useful because what follows is when he grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays at such games as toy plows, tip cat, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy carts, and a toy bow and arrow. When he grows up further and his faculties mature still further, the youth enjoys himself provided in endows with the 5 chords of sense pleasures. With forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, smells cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. Okay, so a little kid gets born, and they start getting sensory input, and some of it is pretty cool stuff, and some of it, obviously, they don't like, right? On seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it if it is pleasing, he dislikes it if it is unpleasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished with a limited mind, and he does not understand as it is. the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Engaged as he is in favoring and opposing, whatever Vedna he experiences, whether pleasant, painful, or neither, he delights in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. Now that just seems a little weird. I could see that for the pleasant Vedna. The unpleasant Vedna, no, that doesn't actually work. And the neutral Vedna, the neither, doesn't work for that either. It appears that the sutta has gotten a bit corrupted here. You know, we find things like this where the chanting goes along and the chanting makes really good sense. It's got a nice rhythm and things get repeated and it's easy to memorize. And then you look carefully and it's like, that didn't quite make sense. All right, so engaged as he is in favoring and opposing, whatever Vedna he experiences that's pleasant, he delights in that Vedna, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, delight arises in him. Now, delight in Vedna is clinging. With clinging as condition, becoming. With becoming as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of dukkha. All right, so basically, a kid gets born, they start getting pleasant things, and they start grasping after that. That grasping leads to clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, and all the dukkha. And then this is repeated for each of the other four senses: hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So then the Buddha gives some of the gradual training. Here, bhikkhus, a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened, etc. And someone hears the Dhamma, gains faith, goes forth, keeps the precepts, guards the senses, is mindful of all that they do, content with little, sits down to practice, overcomes the hindrances. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, one enters and abides in the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Having practiced the jhanas, on seeing a form with the eye, one does not lust after it is pleasing. One does not dislike it if it is unpleasing. One abides with mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable mind, and one understands as it actually is the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having thus abandoned favoring and opposing, whatever Vedna he experiences, whether pleasant or painful or neither, he does not delight in that feeling, welcome it, or remain holding to it. As he does not do so, delight in Vedna ceases. With the cessation of delight comes the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of becoming, cessation of becoming, cessation of birth, with cessation of birth, the cessation of aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, such is the cessation of the whole mass of dukkha. And then it repeats that for each of the other senses. So basically what the Buddha is saying, if you're getting caught in kama tanha, craving for sense pleasures, you need to practice the jhanas. And then, having practiced the jhanas and looked carefully at all these things that you're becoming attached to, all the things you're craving, all the sense pleasures, and seen what they are, then you can let them go. In other words, you practice the jhanas, and then when you examine the things that you were delighting and lusting in, you see their limitations and you let them go. And then one experiences the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom. Now, this phrase, deliverance of mine and deliverance by wisdom, appears to be something that's a later phrase. Now, by later, I don't know if it was late in the Buddhist teachings. It doesn't show up in suttas that we tend to identify as very early. It tends to show up more in suttas that we identify as later. But sometimes it seems to be inserted into earlier material. So this is a hint that perhaps parts of this sutta, perhaps the whole second part on Kamatanha, is a later composition. It's attached to the Sati Sutta, which seems to me to be an earlier sutta. Or perhaps this later part has been tampered with a bit, just like the first part got tampered with the catechism. So, to summarize, to overcome Bhavatanha, look at the world in terms of streams of dependently arising processes interacting. And to overcome Kamatanha, practice the jhanas. Find something better than the sensory delights of the world and examine the sensory delights of the world and see their limitations. And then we have the conclusion. Bhikkhus, remember this discourse of mine briefly as deliverance in the destruction of craving, which gives the sutta its title. But remember the Bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, is caught up in a vast net of craving, in the trammel of craving. This is what the Blessed One said. The Bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words.